Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series in honor of Martin Luther King Day. We'll hear a talk by Congressman John Lewis, Democrat from Georgia's 5th District. Congressman Lewis will talk about his experiences in the civil rights movement in the 1960s, his association with Martin Luther King, and his participation in the march in Selma, Alabama, which has become known as Bloody Sunday. He spoke to an audience of students from area middle schools, high schools, and universities. Congressman Lewis's appearance was made possible through an invitation by Nebraska's 2nd District Congressman Lee Terry and was presented in conjunction with the Durham Museum's recent exhibit, Eyewitness, American Originals from the National Archives. This program is recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday morning, October 10th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
John Robert Lewis, born February 21, 1940, is a U.S. politician and was a leader in the American Civil Rights Movement. He was chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, and played a key role in the struggle to end segregation. Congressman Lewis has represented Georgia's 5th Congressional District in the United States House of Representatives since 1987. The district encompasses almost all of Atlanta. Congressman Lewis and his wife Lillian live in Atlanta. They have one son, John Miles. John Lewis is a pioneer. John Lewis is a trailblazer. John Lewis is an American icon with the American Civil Rights Movement. As I explained to my two oldest children, a senior and freshman, respectively, at Millard South High School, I said, if Willie Mays is the greatest living baseball player, John Lewis is the greatest living civil rights activist. I got about the same response, which means we got to have a discussion sometime down the road about who Willie Mays is. And so I said, okay, try this. John Lewis is to civil rights as to what Run DMC is to rap music. And we have proof that Congressman Lewis... from the National Hip Hop Convention. He was there. So it is my honor to introduce to you the Honorable John R. Lewis.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me just say that I'm delighted, very happy, and very pleased to be here this morning, to be here in the Durham Museum. I want to thank the Executive Director, Leo Smith. I want to thank my friend, my brother, Mick, for those kind words of introduction. And I want to thank all of the board members for all of your help and for all of your support, and thank my good friend, the congressperson from the 5th District. Thank you. Good to see you. From this district, my district is the 5th District of Georgia, and a representative of the two senators. Now, you know, I grew up in rural Alabama, about 50 miles from Montgomery, outside of a little place called Troy. My father was a sharecropper, a tenant farmer. But back in 1944, when I was 4 years old, and I do remember when I was four, I really do, my father had saved $300. How many of you remember when you were 4 years old? Any of you? Oh, you can do better. What happened to you? Well, I remember when I was 4 years old in 1944. My father had saved $300. And with the $300, he bought 110 acres of land. It was a lot of land for $300. My family still owned this land. On this farm, we raised a lot of cotton and corn, a lot of peanuts, hogs, cows, and chickens. Do any of you know anything about raising chickens? I know, well, you know a lot about playing football, right? Yeah. And you raise a lot of beef, right? A lot of corn, but you don't know anything about raising chickens. But let me tell you what I had to do as a young boy growing up in rural Alabama during the 40s and the 50s. I had to take the fresh eggs, mark them with a pencil, place them under the setting hen, and wait for 3 long weeks for the little chicks to hatch. Some of you may be saying, as students and as teachers, now, John Lewis, why do you mark those fresh eggs with a pencil before you place them under the setting hen? Well, from time to time, another hen would get on that same nest, and there would be some more eggs. And you had to be able to tell the fresh eggs from the eggs that were already under the setting hen. Do you follow me? You don't follow me. That's okay. When these chicks would hatch, I would fool these setting hens. I would cheat on these setting hens. I would take these little chicks, give them to another hen, I'll put them in a box with a lantern, raise them on their own, get some more fresh eggs, mark them with a pencil, place them under the setting hen, encourage the setting hen to stay on the nest for another 3 weeks. I kept on fooling and cheating on these setting hens. And when I look back on it, it was not the right thing to do. It was not the moral thing to do. It was not the most loving thing to do. It was not the most non-violent thing to do. But I kept on cheating on these setting hens because I was never quite able to save $18.98 to order the most inexpensive incubator or hatcher from the Susan Roe Buck store. Now, as students, as young people, you don't remember. But many, many years ago, your mothers and fathers, maybe your grandmothers and grandfathers, we get a catalog, and some people call it, it's a big, thick book from Susan Roe Buck, and they would call it the ordering book. And we would get it, and we would order everything. And sometimes we would call this book the wish book. I wish I had this. I wish I had that. And I was never able to save enough money, so I kept on cheating on this setting in. And as I told a group last night, as a young child, about 4 and a half, or 5 years old, or 6 or 7 or 8, I wanted to be a minister. I wanted to preach the gospel. So from time to time, with the help of my brothers and sisters and my fresh cousins, we would get all of our chickens together and put them in the chicken yard. My brothers and sisters and my fresh cousins, alone with my mother and father sometime, we gather in the chicken yard. And I would become the minister. The chickens would make up the congregation, the audience. And I would start preaching. And when I look back on it, some of the chickens would bow their heads. Some of the chickens would shake their heads. They never quite said amen. But as I said to Congressman Terry last night, some of those chickens that I preached to during the 40s and the 50s tended to listen to me much better than some of my colleagues listened to me today in the Congress. And some of those chickens were a little more productive. At least they produce aid. Well, don't tell any of our colleagues I said that. Don't tell them. But that's enough of that. When I would visit the little town of Troy, visit Montgomery, visit a little town called Tuskegee, I saw those signs that said white men, colored women, white waiting. As a young child, I tasted the bitter fruits of segregation and racial discrimination, and I didn't like it. On a Saturday afternoon with my brothers, sisters, and first cousins, we would go downtown to the little town of Troy to the theater, and all of us little black children had to go upstairs to the balcony. And all of the little white children went downstairs to the first floor. I would come home and ask my mother, ask my father, my grandparents, why segregation? Why racial discrimination? And they would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. But one day in 1955, at the age of 15 in the 10th grade, I heard about Rosa Parks. I heard about the bus boycott in Montgomery. I heard the words of Martin Luther King Jr. on the old radio and the words of Dr. King, the action of Rosa Parks inspired me to find a way to get involved in the civil rights movement. In 1956, at the age of 16, with some of my brothers, sisters, and first cousins, we went down to the public library in the little town of Troy, Alabama, 10 miles from my home, trying to check out some books, trying to get a library card. And we were told by the librarian that the library was for whites only and not for coloreds. I never went back to the Pike County Public Library until July 5th, 1998, by this time I'm in the Congress, for a book signing of my book, Walking with the Wind. And hundreds of blacks and white citizens showed up. It was like a big family reunion. We had food, we had something to drink, signed a lot of books. End of the program, they gave me a library card. It says something about the distance we've come and the progress we've made in laying down the burden of race in America. When I finished high school, let's go back for a moment. When I finished high school in May of 1957, at the age of 17, I wanted to attend a little college called Troy State, now known as Troy University, only 10 miles from my home. I got a copy of an application, submitted my application, my high school transcript. I never heard a word from the school. So I wrote a letter to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I didn't tell my mother, my father, any of my sisters or brothers, any of my teachers. I just wrote a letter to Dr. King and told him I needed his help. I wanted his support. I wanted to attend Troy State. Dr. King wrote me back and sent me a round-trip Greyhound bus ticket and invited me to come to Montgomery. In the meantime, I had been accepted at a little college in Nashville, Tennessee. So in September 1957, an uncle of mine gave me a $100 bill, more money than I ever had, gave me one of these big trunk, a Foot Locker, where I could put my clothes and a few books. I put everything that I own in that Foot Locker except those chickens. And I went off to school to Nashville. And after being in Nashville for about 2 weeks, I told one of my teachers that I'd been in contact with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And this teacher knew Dr. King. They both had attended Morehouse College together in Atlanta. He informed Dr. King that I was in school in Nashville. Martin Luther King Jr. got in touch with me by letter and suggested when I was home for spring break to come and see him. So in March of 1958, by this time I'm 18 years old, my father drove me to the Greyhound bus station on a Saturday morning. I boarded the bus. I traveled the 50 miles from Troy to Montgomery. I'd never seen a lawyer before. And a young African-American lawyer by the name of Fred Gray met me at the Greyhound bus station and drove me to the First Baptist Church in downtown Montgomery, pastored by a friend of Dr. King, Reverend Ralph Abernathy, a colleague of his in the Civil Rights Movement. He ushered me into the office of the church, and I saw Martin Luther King Jr. and Ralph Abernathy standing behind a desk. I was so scared, I didn't know what to say or what to do. And Dr. King spoke up and said, "Are you the boy from Troy? Are you John Lewis?" And I said, "Dr. King, I am John Robert Lewis." I gave my whole name. That was the beginning of my involvement in the Civil Rights Movement. I continued to study in Nashville. My folks, my mother, my father were so afraid. They didn't want to have anything to do with Troy State. They didn't want us to file a suit against the state of Alabama or the State Board of Education. They thought the home would be bombed, that we would lose the land. And I continued to study in Nashville. And it was in Nashville, Tennessee, that we started studying the way of nonviolence, the way of passive resistance. We studied the great religions of the world. We studied what Gandhi attempted to do in South Africa, what he accomplished in India. We studied Thoreau and civil disobedience. We studied what Martin Luther King Jr. was all about in Montgomery. And then we started sitting in at lunch counters and restaurants in downtown Nashville. Be sitting there in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion, waiting to be served. And someone would come up and spit on us or put a lighted cigarette out in our hair or down our backs, pull us off the lunch counter stool. We would be beaten, arrested, and taken to jail and charged with disorderly conduct, disturbing the peace, parading without a permit. I got arrested the first time on February the 27th, 1960. I felt free. I felt liberated. I felt like I crossed over. And then we went on something called a freedom ride, my first trip to Washington, D.C., in May of 1961, 13 of us, seven whites and six African-American. Back in 1961, blacks and whites couldn't board a Greyhound bus or a Trailway bus or a train and travel together, be seated together, traveling from Washington, D.C., into Virginia, through North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, into New Orleans, without the possibility of being arrested or jailed. And we had to change that. Along the way, we were arrested. In jail, we were beaten. But it led to the desegregation of public transportation all across the South. And then I went back to Washington the second time in 1963. By this time, I moved to Atlanta and became chair of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, one of the major civil rights groups. And President Kennedy invited a group of us to come, and I went along with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and a few others. And it was in that meeting with President Kennedy that one of the leaders spoke up and said to the president, we were going to march on Washington. Hundreds and thousands of young people, students, college students, blacks and whites, have been arrested for sitting in, going on a freedom ride, organizing people to register to vote. President Kennedy didn't like what he heard. He said to us, if you bring all these people to Washington, won't there be violence and chaos and disorder, and we would never get a civil rights bill through the Congress? And we said, Mr. President, we're going to march on Washington. The six of us met a few days later on July 2nd, 1963, in New York City, and invited four major white religious and labor leaders to join us in issuing the call for the march on Washington. Between July 2nd, 1963, and August 28, 1963, we mobilized America, and more than 250,000 Americans came to Washington and heard Dr. King say, I have a dream. I have a dream today, a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. Dr. King spoke number 10, there were 10 speakers. He was the 10th speaker. I spoke number 6. And out of the 10 people that spoke that day, I'm the only one still around. While I was working on my March on Washington speech, I was reading a copy of the New York Times. And I saw a group of black women in Southern Africa carrying signs saying, one man, one vote. So in my March on Washington speech, I said something like, one man, one vote is the African cry. It is ours too. It must be ours. That became the rallying cry for the young people throughout the South working in the civil rights movement. Back in 1961, 62, 63, 64, 65, it was very hard and very difficult for people of color to register to vote. The state of Mississippi in 1963, 64, 65 had a black voting age population of more than 450,000, and only about 16,000 blacks were registered to vote. There was one county in the state of Alabama, my native state, Lowndes County, between Selma and Montgomery. The county was more than 80% African American. There was not a single registered African American voter in the county. People were afraid. They were afraid to be afraid. People stood in unmovable line. My organization, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, better known as SNCC, organized something called the Mississippi Summer Project, where we recruited more than 1,000 students from all over America, from the colleges and universities, rabbis, priests, nuns, ministers, lawyers, teachers to come to Mississippi. The summer night of June 21st, 1964, three young men that I knew, Andy Goodman, Mickey Schreiner, white, James Shaney, African-American, went out to investigate the burning of an African-American church, a church to be used as voter registration workshops. These three young men were stopped by the sheriff, arrested, taken to jail. Later that evening, they were taken from jail, turned over to the Klan, where they were beaten, shot, and killed. These three young men didn't die in Vietnam. They didn't die in the Middle East. They didn't die in Eastern Europe or in Central or South America. They died right here in our own country, trying to get all of our citizens to become participants in the democratic process. We didn't give up. That was a sad and dark hour for the movement. We didn't become bitter. We didn't become hostile. We kept the faith and kept our eyes on the prize. On July 2nd, 1964, President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He won a landslide election in November 1964. In December 1964, Martin Luther King Jr. received the Nobel Peace Prize. He come back to America, hold a meeting with President Johnson at the White House, and he tell the president, we need a strong Voting Rights Act. And Lyndon Johnson tell Dr. King in so many words, we don't have the votes in the Congress to get a Voting Rights Act passed. I just signed a Civil Rights Act. Dr. King come back to Atlanta. He meet with a group of us, and he said, we will write that act. And he made a decision to join us in Selma, Alabama. In Selma, Alabama, in 1965, only 2.1% of blacks of voting age were registered to vote. People stood in what I call unmovable lines. The only time you could attempt to register was the first and third Mondays of each month. And the only place was the county courthouse. And in Selma, Alabama, you had a sheriff by the name of Jim Clark. He was a very big man. He was tall. He was mean. He wore a gun on one side, a nightstick on the other side. He carried an electric Caprada in his hand, and he didn't use it on cows. He wore a button on his left lapel, and it said, never. On January 18, 1965, it was my day to lead a group of people down to the courthouse, about 60 people, elderly black men and women, just trying to get up a set of steps through a set of double doors to get a copy of the so-called literacy test. For many years, people throughout the state of Alabama had flunked the so-called literacy test. They were told they could not read or write well enough. There were black teachers, black lawyers, black doctors, ministers, housewives, farmers, but flunked his so-called literacy test. On one occasion, there was a man who had a PhD degree who asked to count the numbers of bubbles in a bar of soap, and he failed. Another man was asked to count the numbers of jelly beans in a jar. He failed, so he flunked the test. He could not register to vote. But on that day, Sheriff Clark looked at me and he said, John Lewis, you're not a slight agitator. You're the lowest form of humanity. At that time, I had all of my hair. I was a few pounds lighter. I looked at the sheriff, and I said, Sheriff, I may be an agitator, but I'm not an outsider. I grew up only 90 miles from here, and we're going to stay here until these people are allowed to register to vote. And he said, you're under arrest. And he arrested a group of us and took us to jail. A few days later, Martin Luther King Jr., Reverend Ralph Abernathy, and others came to Selma, and more than 300 people were arrested. We filled the city jail, the county jail. Dr. King, Reverend Abernathy, school teachers, students, all went to jail. And then about 3 weeks later, in a little town called Marion, Alabama, this is in the heart of the Black Belt of Alabama, the hometown of Mrs. Martin Luther King Jr., Mrs. Andrew Young, and Mrs. Ralph Abernathy, all three from the same county, Perry County. Marion, Alabama is the county seat. There was a demonstration for the right to vote one evening. A confrontation occurred, and a young man by the name of Jimmy Lee Jackson tried to protect his mother. He was shot in the stomach by a state trooper. And a few days later, he died at the Good Samaritan Hospital in Selma. And because of what happened to him, we made a decision to march from Selma to Montgomery. We attended church at a little church called Brown Chapel AME Church. And after the services, 600 of us came out into the parking lot, and we conducted a nonviolent workshop. We lined up in twos to walk in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion from Selma to Montgomery. If you notice from the film, from the video, I was wearing a backpack before it became fashionable to wear backpacks. I thought we were going to be arrested and that we were going to jail. So in this backpack and in jail, I wanted to have something to read. I had two books. I wanted to have something to eat. I had an apple and I had an orange. That wouldn't last long. And since I was going to be in jail with my friends, my colleagues and neighbors, I wanted to be able to brush my teeth. I had toothpaste and toothbrush. Crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge, we get to the edge of the water. Jose Williams said to me, "John, can you swim?" And I said, "No." I said, "Jose, can you swim?" He said, "Yes, a little." And I said something like, "Well, there's too much water down there. We're not going to jump. We're going forward." And we continued to walk. And we came to the highest point on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Down below, we saw a sea of blue. Alabama state troopers. And behind the state troopers, we saw members of Sheriff Clark Posse on horseback. We come within hearing distance of the state troopers. A man identified himself by the name of Major John Cloud. He said, "I'm Major John Cloud of the Alabama state troopers. This is an unlawful march. It will not be allowed to continue. I give you 3 minutes to disperse and return to your church." Less than a minute and a half, the major said, "Troopers, advance." And you saw these men putting on their gas masks. They came toward us, beating us with nightsticks and bullwhips and tramping us with horses, releasing the tear gas. Was hit in the head by a state trooper with a nightstick. I had a concussion at the bridge. I thought I saw death. I thought I was going to die. I thought it was my last protest. 43 years later, I don't recall, I made it back across that bridge, through the streets of Selma, back to this little church. I do recall being at the church that afternoon. The church is full to capacity. More than 2,000 people on the outside trying to get in to protest what had happened on the bridge. And someone asked me to say something. And I stood up and said something like, "I don't understand it. How President Johnson can send troops to Vietnam, but cannot send troops to Selma, Alabama, to protect people who only desire to register to vote." The next thing I knew, I'd been admitted to the Good Samaritan Hospital there in Selma. Early the next morning, that Monday morning, Martin Luther King Jr. and Reverend Ralph Abernathy came by to visit me. Because of what happened in Selma, that day became known as Bloody Sunday. The President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, invited the Governor of Alabama, Governor Wallace, to Washington to meet with him, to try to assure him that he would be able to protect us, and he couldn't. So President Johnson federalized the Alabama National Guards, called out part of the United States military to protect us. And President Johnson came to a joint session of the Congress and made one of the most meaningful speeches any American president had made in modern time on the whole question of voting rights or civil rights. He made that speech on March 15th. And maybe you should take a look at that speech and read that speech. He started off that night by saying, "I speak tonight for the dignity of man and for the destiny of democracy." He went on to say, "At time, history and fate meet in a single place in man unending search for freedom." So it was more than a century ago at Lexington, at Concord. So it was at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama. He introduced the Voting Rights Act to a joint session of the Congress. And before he concluded that speech, he said, "And we shall overcome, and we shall overcome." The Congress gave President Johnson a standing ovation. I was sitting next to Martin Luther King Jr., and we watched and listened to President Johnson. And I looked at Dr. King, and tears came down his face. He started crying. And we all cried a little to hear the President of the United States saying, "We shall overcome." The Congress debated the Voting Rights Act, passed it, and President Johnson signed it into law on August 6, 1965. So it is a piece of history. Now in America, everybody can participate in the democratic process, can become registered and vote. And for you to be here in Durham Museum during this election year and walk through this beautiful, unbelievable museum and witness this little piece of history that changed America forever, transform our politics. And our country is a much better country, and we are a much better people. Thank you so much for having me here today.
We have a few brief questions.
At this time, we would like for the students who have prepared questions, if they would work their way down. We have a few minutes available for a question and answer, so would those students come forward, please?
Good morning, Congressman Lewis.
Good morning.
Hello. On Bloody Sunday, with you being the leader of all those African Americans during that protest, what went through your mind as you approached the officers?
On that day, on that Sunday afternoon, March 7, 1965, I really thought that we would be arrested in an orderly fashion and taken to jail. I was prepared to go to jail. I was not prepared for any type of confrontation. And when all this many years later, when I see the film footage or the still photograph, to me, it's still unreal. It's unbelievable. We had a right to protest in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion. We were ordered. We were so orderly and so peaceful. We were not blocking traffic. We were walking on the sidewalk in twos. And the federal judge ruled later that we had a right to march and walk all the way from Selma to Montgomery. And that's why President Johnson called out the United States military to protect us as we walked.
Thank you very
much.
The next student asked, looking back on all your experiences in the civil rights movement, is there anything you would have liked to have done differently?
Well, that's a wonderful question. More than anything else, I regret that I didn't talk with Dr. King more and spend more time with him. I got to know him fairly well, but I didn't have any idea that he would be taken from us so soon. He was my inspiration. He was my leader, almost like a big brother, my hero. And every single day I miss him. On the march from Selma to Montgomery, one day after, we were marching, and he walked with us all the way after Bloody Sunday. 2 weeks later, the heavens opened up and it started raining, just raining. And he had a little cap on, and he took the cap off his head and put it on my head and said, "John, wear this cap. You've been hurt. You need to protect your head." I don't know what happened to the cap. I don't know what happened to my backpack or my trench coat. And I think about that quite often.
Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning.
My name is Tysha Smith, and my question for you is, knowing that you was a part of the civil rights movement, how does it feel to look in this room and see all of us segregated as one and knowing that you had something to do with that?
Well, it's a great feeling, and I think it's a wonderful feeling to see everybody here, to see all of you here today. I tell a little story, and I didn't have time to really kind of ran out of time. I tell a little story from time to time by growing up in a community with my aunt and my mother and father and my first cousin, my sisters and brothers. And I make it brief. A storm came up, and my aunt lived in a shotgun house, and we all were in her house. We had been playing out in the yard. And the storm came up, and the wind started blowing, and the thunder started rolling, and the lightning started flashing. This is a true story. And my aunt became terrified. She thought the house was going to blow away. She had all us to hold hands. And when one corner of this house appeared to be lifted, she had us to walk to that side to try to hold the house down. When the other side appeared, had us to walk to that side. So that's why I wrote this little book, and I call it Walking with the Wind. And I think in America, in a sense, we've been walking with the wind. So it doesn't matter whether we're black or white or a Latino, or Asian American, or Native American. We're one people. We're one family. We all live in the same house. And as Dr. King said, we all must learn to live together as brothers and sisters, or we perish as fools.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A student from the Jesuit Middle School asked, was it hard to be a pacifist while this was happening to you?
That's a wonderful question, sir. That's a wonderful question. Long before we started sitting in, long before going on the Freedom Ride, long before getting involved in a march or standing in at a segregated theater, we studied the way of nonviolence. We studied the way of peace. And many of us grew to accept nonviolence as a way of life, as a way of living. You come to that point where you recognize and respect the dignity and the worth of every human being. And you make up your mind. You have what I call an executive session with yourself. And you say, Seth, I'm not going to hate. Hate is too heavy a burden to bear. I'm going to love. I'm going to love everybody. And in my book, I make the point that when we come into this world, we're innocent little children. And I'd like to thank the Governor Wallace, the governor of Alabama, Bull Connor, who was the police commissioner in Birmingham, who had the dogs turn on the people and use the fire hoses. They didn't come in hating people because of their race and color. They were born as innocent young children, young babies. And something happened, maybe with the environment. So it was not hard for me because I got arrested 40 times. 40 times during the 60s. Beaten and left bloody, unconscious at the Greyhound bus station in Montgomery in May of 1961 during the Freedom Ride. As you heard me say, I had a concussion at the bridge in Selma. But I didn't give up. I didn't become bitter. I never thought about striking back. You have to have the capacity and the ability to forgive and keep forgiving and keep forgiving and just love everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Another questioner asked, after going through everything with the civil rights movement, what's going through your mind with the impending inauguration of a black president?
Well, I must tell you, it is unreal. It is unbelievable. If someone had told me 40 years ago, 45 years ago, when I stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial with Dr. King, or 43 years ago when I walked across that bridge, that one day I would live to see an African-American being nominated to carry the banner for a major political party in America with an unbelievable chance of becoming president of the United States. I would have said, you're crazy, you're out of your mind, you don't know what you're talking about. But it says something about the ability and the capacity of us as a nation and as a people to move, to bring about change. And it is what I call a nonviolent revolution is occurring in America. A revolution of values, a revolution of ideas.
The next question was, before you marched on Bloody Sunday, what was America's overall view of the civil rights movement?
Well, before we marched from attempted to march from Selma to Montgomery on Bloody Sunday, America was in the process of change. Through the work of Dr. King and so many others in the Congress, the President, the Attorney General, but the American people, especially in the religious community, in the colleges and universities, people were being educated and sensitized. The Civil Rights Movement and television sort of came of age, sort of together. So when people saw these unbelievable young people sitting down at lunch counters, well-dressed college students and high students, just sitting there trying to get served, trying to get a hamburger, trying to get a soft drink, trying to get a milkshake, trying to enter a public school, trying to check out books at a public library. And so what was happening to people? They couldn't believe it. Television helped to educate and inform people what racial discrimination was like in America. People didn't believe it. And when a lot of young college students came south to work in Mississippi, in Alabama, and in Georgia, and they went back to their college campus, they went back to their mothers and fathers and their grandparents and their religious leaders, they informed them what it was all about. and that helped change America. And by the time Dr. King gave his magnificent speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, that helped to educate and made America better and different. And so the march, attempt to march from Selma to Montgomery, people couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe that people could not register to vote simply because of the color of their skin. Couldn't believe that people had to pay a poll tax in many of the southern states. So it was a different country, and now we have made it better for everybody.
The final student question was, what was your biggest success in the civil rights movement?
Well, more than anything else, the passage of the 64 Civil Rights Act, making it illegal to discriminate against people in places of public accommodation. Just think a few short years ago, in Montgomery, in Birmingham, as black and white high school students, you wouldn't have been able to ride in the same taxi cab together. You wouldn't have been allowed to sit down together in a restaurant or stay in the same hotel. And with the Voting Rights Act, it made it possible for everybody to become every citizen, make no difference how poor, how wealthy, that you had an opportunity to participate in the democratic process. Getting the Civil Rights Act of 64 passed and the Voting Rights Act of 65 passed changed America. And I feel more than lucky but very blessed that I had an opportunity to play a role in bringing it all about.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series. We have heard a talk by Georgia Congressman Democrat John Lewis. His topic was Bloody Sunday. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday morning, October 10th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. More information on other lectures in the Durham Museum series can be found at durhammuseum.org. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening. We're going to conclude today's special Martin Luther King Day Noon Forum program with a complete recording of Dr. King's speech given at the March on Washington on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, Wednesday, August 28, 1963.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro has still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. And so we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protests to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny. They have come to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. And as we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the city. We cannot be satisfied. As long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one, we can never be satisfied. As long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating for whites only. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote, and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, no, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution. Yes. And staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities. Knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Yes. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. Yes. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. Yes. I have a dream that one day, yes, this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yes. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, tears of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."